ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National, a show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
His name is Kevin Warsh. He's an economist, and if Donald Trump has his way, he'll soon become one of the most important economic figures in the world. The US president has tipped Warsh to replace Jerome Powell as chair of the US Federal Reserve, America's central bank. And Kevin Warsh is pretty clear about his view on central bank independence. Sure, he's in favour of it, but not unequivocally so.
I believe in the operational independence in the conduct of monetary policy as a political economy matter. I think the economy is better off if the world perceives, markets perceive, members of Congress perceive, you got central banks that are calling it the best they see it. Being a central banker is not a prize for the perfect. These are hard jobs, lots of uncertainty, the data is a mess. But the world's better off if they think they're doing their level best to call balls and strikes. But the operational conduct of monetary policy doesn't mean that the Fed shouldn't be criticized. Central bankers should not be pampered princes. If Chairman Hill and his colleagues think that we're doing a terrible job at the central bank, they should be able to call it out. Same thing with the president.
Hello and welcome to Rear Vision. I'm Anthony Fennell. Today on the program, a question of independence and accountability. Central banks and the historic role they play in calming economic waters and preventing crises. Now, the United States is important in this story, but it's not the be-all and the end-all. Questions about independence have certainly come to a fiery head in the US recently, but tensions between political leaders and central bankers are occurring to one degree or another right across the world. So before we return to the situation in the USA, we'll first look at how and why central banks took on their current form. And along the way, we'll use Australia's Reserve Bank as a bit of an example.
I'm Dr. John Hawkins. I'm head of the Canberra School of Government at the University of Canberra. So some central banks have very long histories. Sweden's Riksbank was founded in 1668. The Bank of England was founded in 1694. They didn't all operate as central banks do today back in the 17th century, though. So it's been a gradual sort of evolution. And probably after the Second World War, a lot of new central banks were established and central banking became much more like we know it now.
In many developed countries like Canada, New Zealand and the United States, the need for a central bank began to take on a sense of urgency at the beginning of the 20th century as industrialisation geared up and economies expanded. That was also true of Australia, but in Australia's case, creating a purpose-built institution took considerable time.
So the precursor was the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, and that was set up in 1911. Now, when that was set up, it was more as a saving and trading bank, but it had some central banking, embryonic, if you like, central banking responsibilities. And with legislation over the years, 1924, 1945, it gradually took on more central banking roles. And by the 1950s, there was a sort of a tension that the Commonwealth Bank was seen as both a competitor on the field with the private banks, but also the referee at the same time. And that was sort of seen as giving it an unfair advantage. So there became pressure to split off those commercial banking operations from the central banking role. So in 1960, the Reserve Bank of Australia opens, and it's purely a central bank, and the savings and trading bank operations are run by the Commonwealth Banking Corporation, so they're split.
So what exactly were central banks created to do? What need do they serve?
Initially, it was the issue of currency, banknotes. They're printed by the central bank. It also supervises the banks in many countries, although that's now partly taken over by APRA in Australia, Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority. The central bank's also the lender of last resort. And so if a bank gets in trouble, there's a run on the bank, but it's sort of fundamentally sound, the central bank can provide money to tide it over. So they're some of the main roles of the central bank. Today, they're mainly known for setting interest rates as a way of managing the economy. So typically, the central bank will announce the interest rate it wants to see in the overnight interbank market, and that interest rate then flows into the interest rates that customers pay, so interest rates on home mortgages in Australia, for example. And that in turn affects the pace of economic growth and state of the economy and therefore inflation. And since the early 1990s, increasingly central banks have looked at an inflation target to guide them in whether they put interest rates up or put interest rates down. So they look and say, is the outlook for inflation higher than the target, in which case we'll put interest rates up, or are we going below the target, in which case we'd lower interest rates?
And that's an important point to understand, because while mainstream media and many politicians routinely focus simply on how interest rate decisions will impact on housing prices and housing affordability, central banks like Australia's Reserve Bank actually have their eye on inflation, on keeping it down. And that focus on inflation was key to the notion and development of central bank independence.
So for the early years of the Reserve Bank, through the 1960s, we had a fixed exchange rate, initially to sterling, then to the dollar, then to a basket of currencies. We then had an adjustable floating exchange rate. And then all those fixed exchange rate regimes didn't seem to work all that well. We had high inflation in the 1970s. There were a lot of academic studies that looked at countries where the central bank was regarded as being sort of beholden to the government, and the central banks that were seen as more independent. So Germany and Switzerland, for example, were seen as independent. And it was observed that inflation was much lower in countries like Germany and Switzerland than it was in other countries. And so there came a push from academics to give independence to the central bank. And so the lesson that was drawn from that was, well, it'd be better if you had an independent body setting interest rates based on the economic needs of the country, rather than politicians setting interest rates based on their short-term political interests.
Now, the emergence of inflation as a serious global problem in the early 1970s saw the Nixon administration terminate what was known as the Bretton Woods Agreement, established after World War II.
The strength of a nation's currency is based on the strength of that nation's economy. Accordingly, I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators. I have directed Secretary Connolly to suspend...
The Bretton Woods Agreement had sought to promote financial stability in global markets, and it did that by pegging the value of the US dollar to the value of gold. And in so doing, the agreement effectively tied major world currencies to the US dollar. So America's shock withdrawal from the agreement spooked the international financial markets. Central bank expert Christina Bodder from Michigan State University.
The thing is that central banks and countries in general find themselves in a world where, okay, so how are we going to run our monetary policy? What should be guiding principles? Can we run a monetary policy that is non-inflationary, even if we don't have an anchor to our currency? And in the mid-70s and then late-70s, you had an inflationary environment where gas was more expensive, which translated generally in higher prices. And so the question sort of became, okay, so what should we do in this environment? We clearly have a problem with inflation. Incidentally, we also have a clear problem with growth in the period. So what should we do? The answer kind of came from the way in which the Central Bank of Germany, the Bundesbank, behaved, which at the time focused on controlling inflation. And that turned out to be sort of the right response in the situation. And central bank independence became a gold standard as more and more countries, important countries like the UK, like Japan, reformed their laws so that they gave more independence to their respective national central banks. And it also became sort of a norm of good governance as the International Monetary Fund adopted it as the way for new economies, well, lesser developed economies, to run their business.
Yeah, so New Zealand was the first country to announce an inflation target. That was in 1990, and Canada followed in 1991. And Australia was also a fairly early adopter. So between 1992 and 1994, we gradually firmed up our 2 to 3% inflation target. A central bank's not going to be able to achieve an inflation target unless it has control over interest rates and can move interest rates so to achieve the inflation target and not have a government saying, we've got an election coming up with your low interest rates.
You know, there's tension always, or it seems to me there's ongoing tension between politicians and central banks. Is that in part due to the fact that politicians benefit from having a central bank and its advice, but also it's a way of deniability, of blaming things on someone else? You know, they've got a scapegoat in a sense. Or is that a very cynical way of looking at it?
It's slightly cynical, but it's not untrue, I think. So both John Howard and Peter Costello and Paul Keating have at various times blamed the central bank for losing elections. So Keating thought the Reserve Bank was too slow to get interest rates down before the election he lost, and Howard and Costello were annoyed that the central bank put interest rates up during an election campaign where one of their slogans was keeping interest rates low. So there certainly can be times when politicians are not happy about the independence of the central bank. But you're right that that also means they can sort of disown interest rate decisions that they know will be unpopular. And I think that's one reason that Jim Chalmers often refers to the independent central bank when interest rates have gone up or when they've not come down and people had hoped they would be.
This is Jim Chalmers, the current Australian Treasurer.
Yes.
So they have a very specific role within a country, but of course, all of our economies in lots of ways are tied, aren't they? Some much more so than others. How much international cooperation is there between central banks?
The interest rates between countries are less tied than they were because we've got floating exchange rates. The central banks do, though, cooperate and they meet together to share their experiences. And the main way they do that is through meetings at the Bank for National Settlements in Basel in Switzerland. So once every couple of months, the central bankers from around the world gather and they share their experiences. It's got a significant balance sheet. It does reserves management for some smaller central banks as well. But its main role is a place where central bankers can come, talk to their peers, share their experiences, learn what worked, what didn't work.
The thing is, right, these central banks are still part of the government, in the sense that governments still have a lot to say regarding how central banks are run. You know, governments appoint the central bankers. Central bankers still respond to legislatures or maybe to the executives. Legislatures can change the laws. Independence really kind of just means that the central banks are not supposed to answer to electoral incentives and that they should be considering generally the data when they make their decisions, not the electoral cycle. But I also want to point out that the reason for independence is that monetary policy is very, very potent, very fast acting. It's kind of very tempting to use it to boost temporarily an economy. Independence is just putting a brake on that temptation. This doesn't mean that governments don't ask for lower rates. Governments all over the world, when faced with a quasi-independent or independent central bank, they ask for low rates. Governments always want lower rates.
Well, thank you all for coming. So today, as you know, the board decided to raise the cash rate by 25 basis points to 3.85%. The recent run of data gives the board a clear enough view that the underlying pulse of inflation is too strong. We've updated our assessment and outlook for the economy and concluded that the cash rate was no longer...
With independence, there's also developed an expectation in recent years that central banks need to be more accountable. That's certainly been the case in Australia. There's now an emphasis on openness about how decisions are made and why. That change has come about largely because decisions on monetary policy, the fancy name for interest rate manipulation, well, those decisions taken at the macro level can have serious impacts on the finances of ordinary citizens.
There was a time when central banks tended to be a bit sort of secretive and not talk to the press very much. Famously, Alan Greenspan, the head of the US Federal Reserve, once said, "If you think I've made myself clear, you must have misunderstood me." this idea of being a little bit ambiguous. That sort of changed. So part of the idea of inflation targeting is having a clear target and the central bank clearly expressing what decisions it was taking and why it was taking them. And over time, the governors started to give more speeches. And as part of the recent reforms, after every central bank board meeting, regardless of whether or not they've changed interest rates, the governor fronts the press for almost an hour press conference, and they can ask questions about anything they want, and they get a response. Four times a year, Reserve Bank issues a detailed document about how they see the economy, how they see it going, the reasons why they've done what they have. A statement is put out at the time they announce every interest rate decision, so eight times a year, and a couple of weeks later, the minutes of the meeting are released. So there is a lot of transparency now. I read an article in the Financial Review this week where someone was complaining that there's too much information and it's too confusing and it might be contradictory, so you can't win.
The move toward a more transparent Reserve Bank of Australia followed recommendations made by an independent review in 2023. And that review also recommended that the board of the Reserve Bank be broken in two, in line with similar systems operating in the UK and Canada. Dr. Isaac Gross from Monash University.
Well, the board was effectively doing two jobs previously. On one hand, it was setting monetary policy, whether interest rates go up or down. And it was also fulfilling the traditional role of a board in any organisation, you know, trying to make sure it's well managed, that it's not taking too large a risk, and that the executive team are doing a good job. And these two tasks have fundamentally different skills. Now, ideally, you want monetary policy set by a bunch of experts in, you know, Australian labour markets, Australian financial markets, and the macroeconomy. Whereas the corporate board side of things, well, obviously you want a group of people who know how to run an organisation and know how to, you know, delegate risk and make sure that, you know, the HR side of things is being handled well. So you had two different jobs that were being done by the same group of people. And what the review discovered was that getting the same group of people to do two very different jobs was ultimately leading to poor outcomes. You had people who were primarily appointed for their expertise in corporate management being asked to run monetary policy. And that meant that they, from time to time, made mistakes when setting monetary policy and weren't holding the RBA governor to account in setting that monetary policy. So the review decided to split these two jobs into two separate boards, a group of corporate experts to run the bank as an organisation and a group of monetary policy experts to help set monetary policy in conjunction with the governor.
And the government's now followed through with that and instituted those two boards. Is it too early to tell whether that will make any kind of significant difference to the way the Reserve Bank operates?
Look, it's still only been a year, so you know, I think we'd still want to see a bit more data before we could definitively declare it a success or not. But I think the early signs are that it is working well. We're already seeing much more interaction between the governor and the press and experts outside of the Reserve Bank of Australia, and a lot more detail in the statements they put out. So, you know, the RBA, when it makes a decision once a quarter, it publishes what's known as a statement on monetary policy. And there's a lot more detail in those statements today than there ever was previously. Detail on the forecasts, what the RBA is thinking, the assumptions they're making, what happens if those assumptions are wrong. So I guess, you know, we could look back in 5 years' time to see if the changes have been a complete success. But I'd say so far the signs are looking good.
And you're listening to Rear Vision, an ABC Radio National production. I'm Anthony Fennell. Today, the conditions that led to the practice of central bank independence, the ability of reserve banks to make decisions on interest rate movements unhindered by political obstruction or pressure. At least that's the theory. And speaking of political pressure, let's now return to the current situation in the United States.
Mortgage rates are down despite the Fed. Scott, you got to work in this guy. He's got some real mental problems. No, there's something wrong with him. It's just, I'll be honest, I'd love to fire his ass. He should be fine. Guy's grossly incompetent.
Now, I don't need to tell you who that was, but I will tell you the target of his invective. Jerome Powell, the outgoing chair of the Federal Reserve, America's central bank. His term expires in May, so he only has a couple more months left in the job. But that hasn't stopped Donald Trump from repeatedly trying to publicly humiliate Mr. Powell, declaring him incompetent, as you heard, and insinuating that the widely regarded Federal Reserve chair had been involved in corruption. Then in January, the US Justice Department announced that they had opened a criminal inquiry into Mr. Powell's behaviour. This was Jerome Powell's response.
I have deep respect for the rule of law and for accountability in our democracy. No one, certainly not the chair of the Federal Reserve, is above the law. But this unprecedented action should be seen in the broader context of the administration's threats and ongoing pressure. The threat of criminal charges is a consequence of the Federal Reserve setting interest rates based on our best assessment of what will serve the public, rather than following the preferences of the president. This is about whether the Fed will be able to continue to set interest rates based on evidence and economic conditions, or whether instead monetary policy will be directed by political pressure or intimidation.
Now, Mr. Powell was immediately supported in his pushback by three former chairs of the Federal Reserve, with one of them, Janet Yellen, describing the criminal investigation against Powell as, quote, extremely chilling. And shortly afterward, 11 of the world's senior central bankers issued the following joint statement.
We stand in full solidarity with the Federal Reserve System and its chair, Jerome H. Powell. The independence of central banks is a cornerstone of price, financial and economic stability in the interests of the citizens that we serve. It is therefore critical to preserve that independence with full respect for the rule of law and democratic accountability.
An unprecedented show of support, you might imagine. But how was it seen in Washington? Christina Bodder again.
So I don't know. I mean, the United States is not in a mood to listen to anyone else from the outside. You know, on the Republican side, there were voices that said, well, this is completely inappropriate to have commentary on internal legal matters from all these foreigners. But I think that support was still important because if there is one thing that President Trump pays attention to is sort of market reaction. And the fact that there was a huge endorsement from all over the world of Jerome Powell is sort of a signal as to what perhaps investors in U.S. Treasuries think, right? And in that way, that voice is still important.
So even though, as I was saying earlier, there's a sort of general consensus around the world that independent central banks are the way to go and that they lead to better economic outcomes, in the U.S., we have a president who thinks he knows better than the head of the Federal Reserve, and he's called him a moron and so on, and thinks that he's getting things completely wrong. Ironically, Jerome Powell was actually appointed by Donald Trump during his first term as president, so he hasn't explained to us why he appointed a moron to head the central bank. But anyway, he wants to lower interest rates, and he wants not just 0.25%, but he wants interest rates down to about 1%. Now, that's the sort of level that interest rates will generally only reach in the middle of a severe recession, so something like COVID or the global financial crisis. And almost every economist would think if you lowered interest rates to 1% now, it would be a recipe for very high inflation in the US. But President Trump is sort of frustrated by the independence of the central bank and frustrated that they're not doing what he wants.
Look, I think it's really concerning. President Donald Trump has tried to fire one member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors on somewhat flimsy grounds. His Justice Department has opened investigations into the chairman. And I think that would be deeply concerning if all these attempts to pressure the Federal Reserve worked. We've seen what's happened in the past when presidents try and pressure the Federal Reserve. Back in the 70s, Richard Nixon tried to do this to the Federal Reserve back then. It resulted in much higher levels of inflation than would have otherwise been the case. So it's certainly a risky business that Trump is playing. Hopefully the Federal Reserve and other parts of the US polity can stand up to those attempts to pressure them. But I guess it remains to be seen whether they'll be effective.
Because there are, or possibly are, flow-on effects for other economies like the Australian economy, aren't they, if the American situation changes for the worse?
That's right. I think when the US economy catches a cold, or sneezes, sorry, everybody else catches a cold. And I think if inflation were to soar out of control in the United States and they had to hike interest rates, try and get it back down under control, maybe even cause a recession, that would definitely affect the Australian economy here. So look, there's, to be honest, not much we can do about it sitting on this side of the Pacific Ocean, but it would certainly affect us if things turn pear-shaped.
As previously mentioned, Jerome Powell's term as Federal Reserve Chair ends in May, and Donald Trump has already nominated the person he wants to take Powell's place. His name is Kevin Warsh. He's an economist, so at least that's something, and he did once work for the Federal Reserve. That was between 2006 and 2011. What else do we know about him?
I think out of the sort of four main contenders that President Trump was considering, he's probably one of the safer, more establishment picks. So I guess from that point of view, that's a relatively positive thing that he's chosen someone with considerable experience at the Federal Reserve and someone who's got a long track record of policymaking. So it's not a complete cowboy, and hopefully that will serve him in good stead should he be appointed to the chairman of the Federal Reserve. On the other hand, he has had a somewhat patchy record of getting policy decisions right. If you look back to some of the statements that he made during the global financial crisis when he was working at the Federal Reserve, wasn't always right. And he's flip-flopped a bit on whether he's a bit of a hawk on inflation, which he used to be, and now he's advocating a more dovish line, which, of course, aligns with what President Trump's preferences are. So, look, he's got a good CV. He was probably one of the better alternatives that Trump was considering. Whether he'll stand up for Federal Reserve independence and make the right policy decisions once he's in office, or sort of bow to Trump's preferences for low interest rates, remains to be seen. So I guess it's a bit of a wait and see.
I know that he has talked about, just in the recent past, in fact last year, about the Fed being too large, that it has, over time it's taken on too many responsibilities and needs to be tightened. Is that a view or an opinion that is widely shared?
Look, I don't know if it's widely shared, but I think it's certainly a legitimate point of view. There tends to be a pattern in the US government where, you know, a crisis comes along or a problem pops up. And because the Federal Reserve's the most competent part of the US federal government, maybe excepting the US military, it usually ends up with more power or more influence after the crisis than it did before. And so if you compare the Federal Reserve today to the Federal Reserve of years gone by, it's certainly got more influence, particularly in the areas of banking and finance regulation, as well as monetary policy, which is its traditional domain. So I think it's a legitimate argument. I think part of the reason the Federal Reserve has grown so much is that it's, you know, very capable, very talented, and usually staffed by some of the best policymakers in Washington, D.C. But it's not unreasonable to sort of want the Federal Reserve to sort of return to its knitting and focus on monetary policy and perhaps leave some of those other policy areas to other institutions.
So Kevin Warsh is the U.S. president's preferred choice for the chairmanship of the Fed, the U.S. central bank. But that doesn't mean he's a shoo-in. There is a confirmation process still to be had. And even if he does eventually get the nod, there is one final check in place that's there to protect the independence of the US Federal Reserve.
So one reason why there's not been a large reaction in financial markets is that US interest rates aren't just set by the chair. It's set by what's called the Federal Open Market Committee, which is a group of 12 members, only three of them appointed by Trump so far. It's thought that they might overrule a chair who wanted to lower interest rates to 1%. If that happened, though, I'm sure Trump will try to get rid of some of the other governors until he gets a majority his way, but that might not happen. The other thing which could stymie Trump's plans is that the appointment has to be ratified by the Senate, and some Republican senators may grow a spine and decide not to appoint somebody who they think will act as Trump's puppet.
John Hawkins from the University of Canberra. We also heard today from Christina Bodder at Michigan State University and Isaac Gross from Monash. Now, if you're interested in matters banking, check out a recent chat my colleague David Marr from Late Night Live had with biographer Richard Vaig. It's all about the 18th century American banker Thomas Willing. Never heard of him? Well, that's why you should have a listen. You'll find a link on our webpage or simply go to ABC Listen. Revision is an ABC Radio National production. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.